Hi, everyone, and welcome back to Haunted History. I'm your host, Megan, and every week I'm going to be taking you on a little journey through our world's haunted history. First and foremost, happy Halloween to all of our amazing listeners. I am very excited also that this episode release actually lands on Halloween Day, given that it's the ultimate night of scares and horror. And I did want to share something really cool that happened recently. I did an interview with Global News for their Halloween episode about the curse of the Poltergeist franchise, as we did one of our recent episodes on it. So it was really cool because Simi Sarah, the woman who interviewed me, actually used to be the host of Breakfast Television back when I first moved to Vancouver in 2007. So I used to watch her every morning when I was getting ready to head out to drama school at the time. So I thought it was really cool that 16 years later, she's talking to me about this podcast. So we're going to post the whole segment on our socials so you can check it out. All right, now it's time to get to today's story. Demon summoner, sadist, child murderer. History is peppered with dark and disturbed characters, people who, left unchecked, exercised untold horrors onto the unsuspecting, the marginalized, and the vulnerable. Often, these folks operated from positions of privilege and power, as we saw last week with our tale about the Blood Countess, Elizabeth Báthory. One man in particular, a precursor to Elizabeth, if you will, takes the cake in terms of bloodshed, madness, and overall mayhem. This man, a perhaps lesser-known counterpart to history's true crime heavy hitters, is alleged to be the fabled inspiration for the fairy tale character Bluebeard. A man reportedly so vile, so inhumane, that he makes the tales surrounding Elizabeth Báthory seem like a walk in the park. Today, I'm telling you the story of child murderer, heretic, and serial killer Gilles Doré. Extreme content warning. This episode is for mature audiences only and contains depictions of violence against children, gore, mutilation, sexual sadism, violence and brutality, sexism, and classism. As we've seen in our many historical recountings, setting is everything. Today, we venture off into 15th century Europe during a period known colloquially as the Hundred Years' War. This period was marked by brutal fighting between French and English houses, with both factions vying for control over the throne of France. The land was steeped in blood, and various French houses were infighting, all clamoring for more riches, more land, more forms of dominance over the peasantry and each other. In this climate, your value was dictated at birth, a random luck of the draw, and who you married could seal your future, for better or for worse. Gilles Doré was born in the Middle Ages around September 4th of the year 1404 in an area known as Chantrossé-sur-Loire in France. Gilles reportedly took his first breath in a room in the Black Tower in his family's castle, Chantrossé. Chantrossé was, in truth, more like a fortress. Erected on the rocky banks of the Loire River, the castle boasted 8 slim turrets that reportedly hosted a slew of nightbirds and loomed menacingly over the Duchy of Brittany. This was an auspicious setting for Gilles' origin story. Gilles' parents were the heirs of 2 extremely wealthy and powerful noble French families. His father, Guy II de Montmorency-Laval-Ray, was a knight and part of the most impressive lineages of Breton families. By marriage, Guy was related to the Baron de Ray, the oldest barons of the Duchy of Brittany. Brittany was a prized area during this time. His mother was named Marie Decran, and she was the only daughter of a man named Jean Decran of the House of Cran. They were an insanely rich Western family. The union of Guy and Marie made them almost unfathomably rich and united their lands, namely Anjou, Poitou, Suze, and Maine. On the day that Gilles was born, Jean watched attentively as his grandson received his first baptism. As the child was christened, Jean declared himself Gilles' father under the eyes of God and pondered the role that his grandson would hold as one of the wealthiest heirs of France. As a child, Gilles was spoiled to the point that his existence was hardly ever on par with anyone else's reality. He was appointed a wet nurse, a woman who cared for him by, among other things, breastfeeding him. Servants cared for him in all the other ways a mother should, thus robbing him of closeness and connection with his birth mother, which was par for the course at the time. The wet nurse served the family until Gilles was 2 or 3 years old. Special attention was paid to young Gilles on all fronts. The temperature of his room had to be perfect. His food was pre-selected to control his moods, and he was given the best of everything. Due to his family's extensive wealth, and also because Gilles was marked early as an intelligent child, no expense was spared in his education either. He was well-versed in the sciences and the arts. Gilles' brightness was noted by his grandfather, who kept a keen eye on his sharp grandson. Gilles' mother, Marie, seemed to veritably disappear from the annals of history after having birthed Gilles' younger brother, René, around 1414. Historical traces of her ceased to exist after this time, and it's theorized that she may have fallen ill and died. Historians have also surmised that she perhaps even died in childbirth. Shortly after this, in a passage that is reminiscent of Robert Baratheon's demise in Game of Thrones, Gilles' father, Guy, died sometime before 1415. Guy was said to have been gored by a wild boar during a hunt, and it's even suggested that Gilles may have witnessed the event. For days after, Guy languished in a state of torpor and pain in his bed, after finally expiring due to what was most likely an awful infection taking over his entire body. It's inferred through source material that young Gilles may have absorbed some of the gruesome aspects of this period, namely the fact that his father, his protector, the head of the family, was dispatched by a wild animal and left to perish slowly, painfully, in a cavalcade of moans and screams of pain ill-befitting of a lord of noble birth. That is to say, with his father's death, Gilles was exposed to prolonged pain and witnessed a man of greatness reduced to a shriveled husk. As Guy teetered on the verge of death, he cultivated enough strength to implore one last wish to his entourage. On the night between the 28th and the 29th of October, Guy made it clear, under oath, that he wished for his sons, then 10-year-old Gilles and toddler René, to be raised by his cousin. His strength was waning, but he remained steadfast. His sons would not, could not, under any circumstances, be raised by his late wife's father, Jean Decran. Shortly after he stated his will, Guy passed away. This left Gilles as the oldest son, the heir to a vast fortune at a very young age. Jean Decran was described by folks of that age as being a man who was not governed by the laws of God and man. He was unprincipled and cunning. His ultimate goals centered around accruing power at any cost. He knew how to manipulate people and used both brute force and sweet, well-placed words in order to achieve his most base desires. Jean took the two boys, Gilles and René, into his care. Gilles displayed tremendous intelligence, studying Latin and reading voraciously. He was very physically gifted as well and trained in the military arts. See, during this time, nobles were sometimes called upon by their king in order to fight on their behalf. Let us not forget that France and England were at war. Gilles was training in order to lead his future men-at-arms into battle, all 200 of them, should the need arise. Gilles' nature, impetuous and hot-headed, would serve him well in battle. Not to mention, the fact that he seemed to have everything kind of given to him produced a desire for him to prove himself. Gilles was fearless on the battlefield, perhaps not out of bravery, but more so because of a desire to feel something. Gilles cemented himself as a military leader quite early. After 1427, there were notable mentions of his military exploits being chronicled. Most notably, he's said to have defeated a certain English commander, Blackburn, at a battle for Chateau de Lude, whereupon he challenged the commander in a single combat, man-to-man, and won. This is a singular feat, as it was not customary at all for noblemen to engage in hand-to-hand combat on the battlefield. It's said that this action cemented his status among his men-at-arms, as well as France's heir apparent, Charles VII. He was invited to court, where he schmoozed with the upper crust and the king himself. Now I'd like you to listen to a little tale, the folk tale of Bluebeard. Bluebeard was a rich nobleman who displayed many expressions of wealth, multiple castles, a gilded carriage, and clothes made of the finest damask silk. However, this man was said to sport a horrendous blue beard, hence the name. His blue beard was perceived as ugly, something that made women run away from him. It was said that Bluebeard scoured the lands in search of a wife. Legends about Bluebeard, however, preceded his quest, as any future wife of his had at one point certainly heard tales of the man whose wives, all six of them, had mysteriously gone missing. He reportedly set his sights on the two daughters of a local widow. The daughters, both fearful, were reluctant to accept this arrangement, having heard tales of Bluebeard's missing wives throughout the years. Undeterred, Bluebeard hosted a lavish banquet at his castle. This feat delighted the youngest of the widow's two daughters, who accepted Bluebeard's marriage proposal. Shortly after, Bluebeard claimed he had to travel away from his residence to the country. He left his new wife a set of keys to his castle. The keys, he said, opened all of the rooms of his residence, save for one, a room in the basement, which he explicitly forbade his new wife from entering. While Bluebeard was away, his new wife hosted a party with her sister and cousins. Inexplicably, she eclipsed herself from the gathering as she was momentarily drawn to the room downstairs. She unlocked the door and found before her a room of horrors. The room was caked in blood, and hanging from the hooks were six bodies of Bluebeard's previous wives, lying in various states of decay. The new wife, terrified, dropped the key in the pool of blood. Panicked, she hastily retrieved it. In a haze of fear, she attempted to wipe off the smear of blood, but to no avail. For you see, the key was imbibed with magic. It was a trap, and the blood smear couldn't be removed. It was a permanent blight on her and a mark of her misdeed. The new wife informed her sister and cousins of her findings. Together, they hatched a plan for her to escape the following day. However, to her surprise, Bluebeard reappeared suddenly from his countryside excursion and demanded to know the status of his precious key. Witnessing the magical bloodstain, Bluebeard scowled. He knew. He knew what she had done. In a last-ditch attempt to save her and her sister's life, the new wife begged for the chance to say one last prayer before Bluebeard ended her the way that he had ended all of his previous wives. The ruse worked. It bought enough time for her cousins and brothers to break into the castle walls and murder Bluebeard on the spot. This freed the new wife from death and allowed her the chance to bury the other wives with dignity. She inherited Bluebeard's castle and eventually married out of love, living happily ever after. The Folk Tale of Bluebeard was originally published by Charles Perrault in his 1697 collection of fairy tales. It's a revision of the classic trope of the feminine character toying with the forbidden, the likes of which have been explored with the story of Pandora and the Box, or even Eve and her apple. By contrast, Bluebeard's new wife finds justice for herself and the old wives. This tale has been woven with the folklore of many Breton dukes through time. Although its framework doesn't align perfectly with Gilles de Rais's mythology, it can be reasoned that, in the broader sense, a wealthy feudal lord and his chamber of horrors would tie in nicely with the lore that would eventually spill out of Gilles' life story. I interjected our story today with the folk tale of Bluebeard in order to remind the listener of the value of storytelling when it comes to sharing community knowledge about threats. Storytelling was a valuable tool for the peasant class. It was used to inform one another of the very real dangers imposed on them by their oppressors. It's also a tale that's often mentioned in the same breath as Gilles, who has often been called the real-life Bluebeard. Now, back to our story. While raising his two grandsons, Jean de Caen took it upon himself to secure alliances and additional finances with other great houses by attempting to marry off Gilles. He attempted two unions with young girls from extremely powerful noble houses, but both attempts failed. Finally, Gilles was eventually formally engaged to a woman named Catherine du Thouars. Catherine was the heiress of the counties of Vendôme and Poitou. Marrying her would make Gilles and his family even richer. The union was frowned upon, as Gilles and Catherine were cousins. There were objections from both sides of the family, as well as the religious authorities, who needed to greenlight all marriages between nobles. In order to remedy the situation, Gilles abducted Catherine. He then proceeded to marry her covertly, without announcing the marriage, as nobles are traditionally supposed to do. Sanctifying the marriage was easy, as Gilles possessed his own personal parish and church. The marriage contract was drawn up in November of 1420. However, the church interjected and declared that the marriage was incestuous. What's interesting about this union, and adds a bit more understanding about Gilles' sexuality, is that this marriage only produced one child, a daughter, born 10 years after the union between Gilles and Catherine began. Catherine's mother, Beatrice de Montchamp, retained many properties to her name when her husband passed away. It's these estates that attracted both Jean de Caen and Gilles de Rais. The grandfather and his grandson had designs on Beatrice's legacy through Gilles' marriage to Catherine. This is why, when Beatrice remarried a squire named Jacques, their plans were foibled. Undeterred, the two set a new plan in motion. Bolstered, I'm sure, by Gilles' successful kidnapping and subsequent marriage to his wife, Gilles took it upon himself to abduct his own mother-in-law, who was then held in the castle Champtocé. Jean and Gilles, grandfather and grandson, both possessed the same mindless lust for power. There at Champtocé, they repeatedly threatened Beatrice. They urged her to transfer her dower to them, or they would sew her in a sack and throw her in a river. This serves as a reminder of Gilles' influence and of his capabilities. He was a man for whom no meant nothing, and trained by his grandfather, he was molded into the form of a man for whom the rules were meant to be broken, wills bent, and hearts crushed. The story of Gilles de Rais cannot be complete, or should I say its historical implication, can't be fully understood without the mention of Gilles' connection to another historical figure. This is the so-called Maid of Orléans, none other than the celebrated figure of Joan of Arc. When Joan of Arc, the virginal woman who heard whispers from God, broke onto the scene in 1429, she was heralding the victory of Charles VII and prophesied that he would be crowned the ruler of France at the cathedral in Reims. This was a tall order to come to pass, as Charles, at the time, was the Dauphin of France, a hereditary title given to the heir apparent. However, at the time, the throne was promised to a young Henry V. When word reached the king of her visions, she was summoned to court, whereupon it said that the king masked himself as a noble. And he had none other than Gilles himself seated on the throne in an attempt to fool the 17-year-old girl. The ruse didn't work, however, as Joan reportedly sensed who the true king was and addressed Charles instead. I can't help but wonder, dear listener, if this story is indeed true, how Gilles must have felt sitting on that throne, even if but for a minute. Perhaps it's this instant that whet his appetite for ultimate power. Either way, he was on a course for military greatness. As such, Gilles, who had fallen into the Dauphin's good graces, began studying courtly manners with him around 1425 and was tasked with watching over Joan as she campaigned in the Siege of Orléans. It's said that Gilles took a fondness for Joan, who openly stated that she had an open line to God. He was present when she inspired French forces during the Siege of Orléans, ultimately leading them to recapture territories that had been previously dominated by the English. The city of Orléans held symbolic value for both the French and the English, as it was believed that if the English regent, John Lancaster, overtook the city of Orléans, the rest of France would follow suit and fall into the English fold, securing the rule for his brother, Henry V. However, the French were greatly inspired by the prophetic nature of Joan of Arc, and Orléans emerged victorious a mere 9 days after her arrival. Gilles would serve as the commander of the royal army from 1427 to 1435. As for the Dauphin, he was crowned king on July 17, 1429, at the cathedral in Reims. Gilles and Joan formed what some historians framed as an unlikely friendship. It's highly unusual and kind of moves away from Gilles' usual way of doing things. Gilles often swooped in when Joan foibled, literally saved her life on more than one occasion. This is because Joan, although she did lead the French army into battles, was no war strategist. She was a woman who heard the voice of God and was a link between the Almighty and the French, the pipeline from heavens, so to speak. By securing continued victory for the French, Joan assured the Dauphin and the French people that they were on the right track. The true nature of Gilles and Joan's relationship is hazy at best. She is the only female friend that he had, and Joan was largely known for her maidenhood, something that was disturbingly and regularly verified by the church during her rise to fame. Indeed, her virginity is what made her holy in the eyes of God and the French people, as well as worthy of their trust. Perhaps it was the fact that by ingratiating himself with Joan and allying himself to her cause, Gilles secured more power and influence for himself. However, let us not forget that he was his grandfather's grandson after all, since by the time Joan was captured and burned at the stake by the English on May 31st, 1431, Gilles was nowhere to be found, and presumably echoed the shifting sentiments of his fellow Frenchmen who had by now labeled Joan as a heretic. Upon his return from war, Gilles, by then a marshal of France, drowned what surely would have been memories of his great feats of inhumanity in an endless procession of parties, banquets, and even a whole theatrical production. Indeed, at some point, Gilles produced a play depicting his actions at the Siege of Orléans that required the aid of over 500 people. Elaborate costumes were sewn and used for one representation, only to be discarded. The same costumes were reported to have been sewn from scratch for the next showing of the production. The whole production, in fact, was a gross display of waste, personal glory, and lavishness. At the time, it was said that Gilles's court rivaled that of the king in its rabid display of wealth and opulence. Gilles's vast estate was one of the most expansive and wealthy in Western France at the time. Gilles spent his fortune with great abandon, chasing a feeling, I'm sure. The man truly excelled in displays of prosperity. He hosted gatherings with hundreds of people and spared no expense when it came to food and wine. He populated his residences with an onslaught of servants and page boys, as well as a retinue of men-at-arms, courtesans, and noble folk. The parties were in quick succession, with some lasting for days on end. This endless stream of debauchery, however, came with a hefty price tag, the likes of which could not be footed forever. As such, Gilles began routinely selling off his family land to finance his lifestyle. As you can imagine, this did not sit well with the other members of his family. It drew some particular ire and disgust from Jean de Coin. You see, Jean de Coin had spent the latter part of his life projecting a great deal onto his grandson, seeing parts of himself in him, I'm sure. The idea that Gilles was squandering the lands and riches that he had connived his whole life to amass was, well, unthinkable. When Jean de Coin died in November of 1432, he bequeathed his prized sword and shield set to Gilles' younger brother, René, as a final testament to his disapproval. René, for his part, had been named the Duc d'Alassuz, and he also carried great bitterness in his heart for Gilles. They would remain enemies for life. With Jean de Coin dead, Gilles was left free to spend at will. However, it was almost as though, now that he was truly unrestrained, the frivolous spending had lost its allure. Gilles began to slip into a personal hell. He had no direction, no narrative tension against which to pit himself, and it's around this time that he seemed to dip into a semblance of what it's like to have a conscience, and sought out any personal redemption with the Almighty God himself. In 1433, eager for a project and prepping himself for salvation, Gilles undertook the construction of a personal chapel. This chapel would be named, chillingly, the Chapel of the Holy Innocents. The chapel was staffed with a choir of boys that were all hand-picked by Gilles himself. However, the plan didn't work. Gilles didn't find personal peace, and he was now more destitute than ever. This is when Gilles reportedly dove headfirst into the crueler elements of his soul, reasoning, perhaps, that if the light hadn't saved him, maybe the darkness would. It's said that when faced with his failing finances, Gilles turned to the occult. Gilles was never rooted in reality. His retinue of servants, men-at-arms, and the compliance of the peasantry shaped his worldview. Because everything came easy for Gilles, the idea of failure was inconceivable. Now, forget making sound decisions or, God forbid, working in order to replenish his coffers. No. Gilles decided that in order to right this perceived wrong, which was entirely of his own making, he needed to dabble in the dark arts. Gilles sent out a priest that he had befriended, named Eustache Blanchette, to seek out someone who could make use of alchemy and summon demons. You see, the concept behind alchemy is that any material can be transformed into gold by way of magic. As for demon summoning, well, it stands to reason that for a man who never did anything for himself, a bargain with the devil may not have been out of the question. A sort of trade, if you will. Eustache sought out an Italian cleric named François Prelati, who was known to be able to summon demons. During this period, Gilles also got his hands on a grimoire, a magical book to aid him in his black magic journey. What's more, it's said that Gilles dropped his usual heaps of finely dressed, fancy nobles in favor of a convoy of sorcerers, alchemists, and dark wizards to help him quench his dark desires. At one of Gilles' castles, it's said that Prelati attempted to summon a demon named Baron who would restore Gilles' wealth and reputation. The men tried, unsuccessfully, and after three attempts, Prelati insisted that the parts of a child's body would be needed in order to complete the ritual successfully. Without hesitation, Gilles left the room only to return minutes later with a glass container. In the glass container were the severed limbs of a child. Even though the right ingredients were obtained, the ritual was unsuccessful, and Gilles, having dispersed quite a bit of money in order to use the services provided by Prelati, was left poorer than he started. This, of course, begs the question, how did Gilles just so happen to have a child's body parts on hand? In the spring of 1432, it was noted that Gilles had on each of his numerous properties dens of indulgence, where he and members of his entourage would engage in any sexual proclivity they desired. Let's not forget that these were nobles, men and women of the upper echelons of society. As such, nothing was forbidden to them. Perhaps this is why they constantly felt the need to chase a stronger feeling. Having never had to delay gratification, the only way to manufacture a sense of satisfaction was to constantly push that envelope. Either way, rumors began circulating that children, both girls and boys, but young boys especially, were going missing in and around Gilles' castles. During that time period, it was customary for families of lower status to send off their sons in service of a local noble as pages or servants. In doing so, it was understood that they may never see their sons again, a paltry price to pay for the times in exchange for knowing that your child was fed and clothed. However, it was said that in Gilles' castles, boys never returned home for a more sinister reason. Upon arriving at one of Gilles' many castles, it was said that a child would be dressed in the finest clothes of the time. Afterwards, a feast of epic proportions would be laid out for Gilles, members of his entourage, and the children in question. Copious amounts of food would be eaten and loads of wine and beer would be consumed. Before long, the child would be taken to a special room. Once there, the true horror would be unleashed. From the locked special room, screams would echo out into the castle's hallways as the child would be hung strategically by ropes and Gilles would masturbate at the sight of their bound, nude body. Pointedly, it was said that it was the shock and horror in the child's eyes that excited Gilles. In an act of ultimate cruelty, Gilles would take the child down and comfort them by telling them that he simply wanted to play. The ordeal would then invariably only end with the child's death. A short sword would be used. The victims' throats would be slashed, their heads brutally severed from their bodies, and their limbs dismembered. It was said that Gilles would sometimes sit on their stomachs as they died, relishing in the moment by laughing. But the dread did not end there. Upon their death, it's said that Gilles carved up the children's bodies and played with their entrails. In a twisted display of the extreme dissonance inside of him, Gilles would also kiss the heads of the children he deemed most beautiful. And it gets worse. Gilles, aside from being a rapist, pedophile, and murderer, was also a necrophiliac. Accounts vary, but it's rumored that he routinely pleasured himself with the neck stumps and other body parts of the children that he decapitated, adding a veneer of pure, undistilled horror to this story. Gilles would either commit the murder himself or have his servants do the deed. The bodies were then disposed of, burned in Gilles' fireplace. All evidence of his misdeeds were then purged by the flames, only remnants floating inside his misshapen conscience like so many fluttering pieces of ash. Here, I would like us to take a moment and weigh in on the French historian Michelet's rightful description of Gilles de Rais as a beast of extermination. It seems like these instances of outright inhumanity showcase just how apart from everyone else Gilles had grown. He had morphed, as it were, into a beast. Because it was customary for families to never be reunited with the sons they had sent off to work for nobles, they wouldn't have known about their deaths right away, if ever. When they did inquire, they were told that their sons had been taken by the English, which didn't seem implausible for the times. However, as these things often go, whispers began pouring out of Gilles' castles and onto the countryside, whispers of a heretic, a child murderer, a man who would stop at nothing to satiate himself. Gilles de Rais, it appeared, had become the real-life villain of a folktale. The first documented case of child snatching appears to be the kidnapping of a 12-year-old boy named Joudon. He was the apprentice of a furrier, which was someone who dealt with furs, and his name was Guillaume. The boy was sought after one day by two men, and asked to join them in one of Gilles' castles. The boy's father, Guillaume, hesitated. The two men in question were Gilles' own cousins. "Don't worry," they said. "We simply need to use him as a messenger to send a message." Guillaume relented, and his boy was never seen again. In 1440, Gilles kidnapped a cleric. The dispute between the men had nothing to do with missing boys, but its brazenness gave authorities the go-ahead to finally arrest Gilles. The Bishop of Nantes, alerted of the kidnapping, sent some folks to investigate. Sources, of course, are hazy, but reports indicate that many, up to 40 bodies of children, were found with visible signs of torture befouling them. Gilles, along with two of his servants, were taken into custody. When Gilles was finally tried, it was for heresy, sodomy, and the murders of upwards of 100 children. Sources vary, but it is said that Gilles was perhaps tortured under investigation. He admitted to kidnapping and ritualistically killing hundreds of children that were supplied to him by his servants for nearly a decade. The two priests who aided him in his demonic rituals, Eustache and Francois, were also tried and supplied ample evidence of Gilles' depraved deeds. However, it's the bulk of the witness testimonies that really sealed Gilles' fate. The local peasantry detailed endless instances of their children knocking on the castle doors, begging for food, only to be never seen again. The family of Joudon, the young furrier's apprentice, also testified. What's terrifying to think about is that the depictions of violence that survive today come from accounts told by Gilles' own accomplices. However, it's said that the most disturbing parts of the accounts were stricken from the record. If that's true, what could be more disturbing than what we've already heard today? Bizarrely, Gilles strongly identifies himself as a religious man, and when faced with the prospect of excommunication and under torture, he confessed to the crimes that he was accused of. For his crimes, he was found guilty of murder by the civil court. For his dalliances with demons, he was convicted of heresy by the church. Because it was said that the bodies of Gilles' victims were burned or buried in unmarked graves, it was really hard to pin down the exact number of his victims. Reportedly, 40 bodies were uncovered, but he was tried for between 80 and 200 murders. It's been theorized that this number could be all the way up to 600. Either way, Gilles has gone down in history as one of the first noted serial killers. On October 26, 1440, in Nantes, Gilles ascended the gallows. Below him, tinder had been stacked in anticipation of an all-consuming fire. He had been sentenced to hang and burn, a double feature deemed appropriate given the depraved nature of his crimes. Two of his accomplices also met their deaths that day. Gilles, unlike his grandfather, had never known when to back down, to use sweet words in order to manipulate others. His inability to show restraint in any facet of his life proved instrumental in his downfall. However, in his last hour, he was said to have displayed contrition for his acts. And I say displayed here because whether or not he actually felt regret is another thing entirely. It's a strange concept, but this outward display of contrition mellowed the crowd somewhat. As opposed to carrying an extended feeling of anger or disgust toward Gilles, they prayed over him as he walked to his death. In the days following his execution, he was marked as a model of Christian penitence. The idea behind this is that at the 11th hour, Gilles had been saved. Gilles had one final wish granted, and it was most likely because of his noble status and the fact that he had successfully manufactured a sense of contrition. He was allowed to be buried in the church of the monastery of Notre Dame des Carmes in Nantes. In a confusing final act, but perhaps one that reminds us of the disconnect between folktales and real life, for nearly a century following Gilles de Rais's execution, his salvation in the eyes of God would be commemorated by parents in Nantes whipping their children. Some celebration. Gilles' legacy is bleak. His connection to the martyred Maiden of France, Joan of Arc, routinely downplayed. Unlike our story about Elizabeth Báthory, it's unclear whether or not Gilles was framed for political reasons. The church, however, did stand to gain from Gilles' death, as it could seize upon his lands and reinstate some of its lost power. Although there is some evidence to suggest that there was an attempt to seize the prized Duchy of Brittany from Gilles, there seems to be more of a consensus that, rather than a ploy to dislodge him from his holdings, some bad things did, in fact, happen in Gilles' castles. Another theory is that Gilles was an openly gay man and was ultimately punished as such. It could be very well that his desire for personal salvation represented the inner turmoil of a man struggling with his inner identity in a Christian moral landscape. What's more likely, sadly, is that Gilles was simply a pedophile, and because of his social status and the way that the servant class operated at the time, he was able to engage in lewd activities with children under relative impunity. He possessed endless wealth, and more importantly, a retinue of people who could clean up, literally and proverbially, all of his messes, be they as bloody as history wants us to believe. I would like to take a moment here to reconcile the horrors of history with what we now know of serial killers today. Sure, the claims laid bare by Gilles and his servants were put forth under torture. Sure, they are outlandish in nature. However, as we've seen with modern serial killers like the pedophile clown John Wayne Gacy, for the psychopathic mind and sexual sadist, pain is where the pleasure comes from. As historians have noted, indications point to Gilles deriving pleasure from the shock and horror of his victims, more than the physical senses. It's therefore not in the realm of the impossible for a psychopath that possesses this rich fantasy life to act out on it, especially if he was molded in a climate of violence, never denied anything in his whole life, and given the means and opportunity to practice every degree of his unspeakable crimes without consequence. Well, that's it for me today. I want to wish you all a very happy Halloween. And if you've enjoyed our time spent together, please take a minute and leave a review or give us a rating. We love that listener interaction. And I'll see you all next Tuesday.